Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Steve Diamond, and today is November 12, 2005, the day after Veterans Day. Our focus today is on listening to alternative voices of veterans. Here's what is coming up. We are pleased to bring you a special Veterans Day edition of Take the Power Back from KYRS LPFM in Spokane, Washington, where U.S. Air Force veteran Mike Kress dedicates his show to veterans, their families, and the victims of war. News, announcements, commentary, and more will also come your way in the next 2 hours, ending with the latest episode of Between the Lines, independent radio out of Connecticut. And now we have some news from this past week that you may have missed. Let's start with a quick story from Foster's, right next door in Dover, printed on November 8th. Bush's popularity in New Hampshire dropping. President Bush's job approval ratings in New Hampshire continue to fall. The latest Grant State poll, released Monday, shows 55% of those surveyed saying they disapprove of the Republicans' performance, 39% approve, and 6% are neutral. Those who strongly disapprove of the job Bush is doing has increased to 44% from 35% in a similar poll in July. The conflict in Iraq and his handling of the economy are dragging down Bush's ratings, say Andrew Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire's Survey Center. The telephone poll of 511 randomly selected adults interviewed between October 25th and October 30th has a margin of error of 4.4 points. In terms of Bush's personal popularity, 52% have an unfavorable opinion, 42% a favorable view, and 6% are neutral. And next, from the British Independent. Powerful new evidence emerged Monday that the United States dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus on the Iraqi city of Fallujah during the attack on the city in November 2004, killing insurgents and civilians with the appalling burns that are the signature of this weapon. Ever since the assault, which went unreported by any Western journalists, rumors have swirled that the Americans used chemical weapons on the city. On November 10th last year, the Islamic Online website wrote, U.S. troops are reportedly using chemical weapons and poisonous gas in this large-scale offensive on the Iraqi resistance bastion of Fallujah, a grim reminder of Saddam Hussein's alleged gassing of the Kurds in 1988. In December, the U.S. government formally denied the reports, describing them as widespread myths. Some news accounts have claimed that U.S. forces have used outlawed phosphorus shells in Fallujah, the U.S. Info website said. Phosphorus shells are not outlawed. U.S. forces have used them very sparingly in Fallujah for illumination purposes. But now new information has surfaced, including hideous photographs and videos and interviews with American soldiers who took part in the Fallujah attack, which provides graphic proof that phosphorus shells were widely deployed in the city as a weapon. In a documentary to be broadcast by RAI, the Italian state broadcaster, a former American soldier who fought at Fallujah says, "I heard the order to pay attention because they were going to use white phosphorus on Fallujah." Phosphorus burns bodies. In fact, it melts the flesh all the way down to the bone. I saw the burned bodies of women and children. Phosphorus explodes and forms a cloud. Anyone within a radius of 150 meters is done for. Photographs on the website of the broadcaster's 24-hour news channel, www.rainews24.it, show exactly what the former soldier means. Provided by the Studies Center of Human Rights in Fallujah, dozens of high-quality, color close-ups show bodies of Fallujah residents, some still in their beds, whose clothes remain largely intact, but whose skin has been dissolved or caramelized or turned the consistency of leather by the shells. A biologist in Fallujah, Mohammed Tariq, interviewed for the film, says, "A rain of fire fell on the city. The people struck by this multicolored substance started to burn. We found people dead with strange wounds. The bodies burned, but the clothes intact." The documentary, entitled Fallujah, The Hidden Massacre, also provides what it claims is clinching evidence that incendiary bombs known as Mark 77, a new, improved form of napalm, was used in the attack on Fallujah, in breach of the UN Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons of 1980, which only allows its use against military targets. And we finish our news segment today with a couple stories quite appropriate for the day after Veterans Day. From the Associated Press, Colorado soldier founds anti-war group. Sergeant Kelly Doherty went to Iraq in 2003, doubting that the war was just. She returned in 2004, certain it was wrong, and co-founded Iraq Veterans Against the War. She said, "People say you are a traitor. People say you are unpatriotic. We are doing this because we feel strongly about America. I really appreciate America, but we are capable of doing some very bad things. Doherty was stationed near Nasiriyah in southern Iraq for 10 months with the Colorado National Guard's 220th Military Police Company. She saw action but never fired her weapon. Doherty said the thousands of innocent civilians who have been killed and the broken American promises about repairing water, electricity, and sewage systems convinced her the troops should come home. The faces of Iraqi civilians mirrored her growing doubts. At first, the Iraqis smiled and waved, but at the end of my 10 months there, they'd turn away or make rude gestures, Doherty said. After she came home in February 2004 and left the Guard after 8 years with an honorable discharge, Doherty embarked on a new mission. She put her life and income on hold to talk to college students, high school classes, and community groups across the country. "The war in Iraq is not about protecting this country. The war is about aggression," said Doherty, who doesn't receive a salary for her work against the war. At Regis College in Denver recently with the Wheels of Justice tour, Doherty said her unit was often ordered to burn broken-down civilian contractor trucks loaded with supplies rather than allow the impoverished Iraqis to loot them for the water, food, fuel, and vehicle parts that could be sold. "Most of us wanted to help the Iraqi people, but the only good we could do was give kids candy," she told 6 Regis students who gathered on a warm fall afternoon to listen to her. "That's not what they need. They need clean water and security." The worst events she experienced involved civilians, including children, hit by contractor convoys that thundered along rural roads under orders to never stop. "I wasn't protecting America. I was protecting Halliburton trucks going to military bases," she said. Doherty said her military police unit provided security for investigators at rural crash sites, including a fatality where a military convoy killed a boy. The family was there. An older relative fell to his knees and collapsed on the ground. There was nothing they could do, she said. Doherty said she had hoped that American troops would help rebuild power plants, water systems, and schools, but the only construction she saw was at military bases. "From what I saw, we just created more chaos and violence," she said. "I became less and less convinced that we were there for a good purpose." The rebuilding effort is the subject of a new report by the Special Investigator General for Iraq. While noting problems in the $300 billion U.S.-financed effort, the report also cited, quote, "steady progress" in parts of the program, despite what was described as, quote, "the hazardous security environment, the fluid political situation, and the harsh realities of working in a war zone," according to a story in a recent Sunday edition of New York Times. Doherty was activated as an MP in January 2003 for duty in Iraq. "Before I went, I told an officer that I had reservations because Iraq wasn't behind the 9/11 attack," she said. The officer said he had reservations, too. That night, however, the officer told the platoon that Iraq was behind the 9/11 attack and that the country needed to strike back, Doherty said. "Our leader was misleading us," she said. Her unit first went to Kuwait, where they huddled in a bunker for 2 days as alarms signaled incoming Scud missiles fired by the Iraqis. "We were in full protective gear because we were told the missiles had chemical and biological weapons," Doherty said. "The soldiers were again misled," she said. The U.S. later said the Iraqis didn't have biological or chemical agents or weapons of mass destruction. And finally, from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, a Department of Defense decision to renege on wartime promises to pay bonuses to more than a dozen re-enlisting Washington National Guardsmen has sparked outrage from prominent elected officials and state National Guard officers working to rectify the situation. According to a state National Guardsman, Major Phil Austerly, at least 15 Washington National Guardsmen and women signed re-enlistment forms promising them a tax-free $15,000 bonus in return. Many of them were stationed in Iraq at the time, he said. But Pentagon officials have said in published reports that the bonuses were canceled because they duplicated other programs and were prohibited. Sergeant First Class Carl Latson is one of those in the Washington National Guard directly affected. The Spanaway man, the 13-year military veteran who said he had served both in Operation Desert Storm and the current Iraq War, re-enlisted in January for another 6-year term, which would have taken him close to retirement from the service. Latson, 35, said Friday that the bonus was a big incentive to re-enlist. At the time it was offered, he was serving in Iraq as an enlisted aide for a general at the Balad Army Base near Baghdad. He signed a re-enlistment form January 17, just after he took the oath from his commanding officer. It said, quote, "For a 6-year re-enlistment extension, I will receive a total bonus of $15,000, reads the official Army National Guard form. After serving 2 years active duty with the Navy and the last 11 years with the National Guard, Latson said, "I re-enlisted because the opportunity was there to finally get a bonus." Latson, who served in Iraq most recently from March 2004 to March 2005, said he has been counting on the money to help buy a house and to support his 11-year-old daughter. He said he knows at least 10 other National Guardsmen in the same boat. "It has made a significant impact on my life," said Latson. "For them to offer a bonus when we're at war, when we're risking our lives, and then to turn around and not pay for it when we return, is the wrong message to send to me, to any soldier. It's not fair." Latson said that regardless of whether he gets the money promised him, he's made one decision. He plans to quit the military long before retirement age. "I'm to the point now where I want to get out," he said. "I'm just really disappointed."
A Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign, sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on a wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. See those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the squares, a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. And the bar is still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd's getting thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage don't pay for a roof. Don't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far $5.15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. There's a high school girl with a bourgeois dream, just like the pictures in the magazine she found on the floor of the laundromat. A woman with kids can forget all that. If she comes up pregnant, what'll she do? Forget the career, forget about school. Can she live on faith, live on hope, high on Jesus or hooked on dope? When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. I'm stocking shirts in the Walmart store, just like the ones we made before, except this one came from Singapore. Guess we can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin, or the shape of their eyes, or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now, they haunt my dreams, all lily white and squeaky clean. They never known want, they never known need. The shit don't stink and their kids won't bleed. Their kids won't bleed in their damn little war, and we can't make it here anymore. We'll work for food, we'll die for oil, we'll kill for power, and to us the spoils. The billionaires get to pay less tax, the working poor get to fall through the cracks. So let them eat jelly beans, let them eat cake, let them eat shit, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. And that's how it is, that's what we got. If the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo, Look us in the eye, call us on the cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains. It's done closed down, along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. And dust devils dance in the noonday heat, and there's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
That was James McCurdy with the acoustic version of We Can't Make It Here. Next, we have a column I wrote for nhindymedia.org called Weapons of Mass Duplicity and Full Spectrum Dominance. It's the elephant in the war room. It's the naked general we're too frightened to laugh at. It's the lie we wish was believable. The premise is that members of the Nuclear Gentlemen's Club will give up their nuclear weapons while preventing anyone else from getting them, making the world safer through diplomacy. While earlier U.S. administrations made a start at arms reduction without the political will to follow through on our broader treaty commitments, the Bush administration has showed determination in undermining those commitments and has actually made belligerent nuclear threats against numerous nations, including China. The balance of madness between the U.S. and USSR, mutually assured destruction, has ended. The Bush administration seems determined that the U.S. can assure our mutual destruction even without the existence of any other superpowers. The new so-called diplomatic strategy towards anyone seeking an effective deterrent against the U.S. is escalation, threats, and covert or overt invasion. Such dictatorial diplomacy has a slight chance of working against nation-states, but only plays into the hands of groups like Al-Qaeda, who have a fundamentalist, apocalyptic worldview similar to George Bush. Since the ratification of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty 30 years ago, the U.S. has made a lot of progress at undermining every principle upon which trust might be based. The U.S. has withdrawn from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and expanded its arsenal, even while recently reiterating its commitment to full nuclear disarmament in 2000. Clearly, that promise had to be made to further U.S. strategic interests, allowing many world leaders to pretend to believe it. But a few nations, at least, ask to be treated as equals, without U.S. military domination and the influence of economic policies we leverage with it. While these lies and double-dealing policies have reached a crescendo under George Bush, he is merely continuing principles that U.S. presidents have historically honored far more rigidly than international law and treaties, which are supposedly the law of the land. Consider this statement by George Kennan, the former head of the U.S. State Department Policy Planning Staff, written in 1948. We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. This disparity is particularly great between ourselves and the peoples of Asia. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships that will permit us to maintain this disparity without a positive detriment to our national security. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford today the luxury of altruism and world benefaction. We should cease to talk about living standards and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are then hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. That was George Kennan. So far, the U.S. has maintained an extremely high standard of living despite a yearly trade deficit approaching $700 billion, a budget deficit of $319 billion and climbing, $627 billion of consumer debt, and a U.S. government debt of over $8 trillion. The U.S. is floating an incredible total national debt across all sectors of over $40 trillion. We are under a massive and apparently unsustainable debt, yet Wall Street continues as normal, hardly perturbed. They know that government and corporate leaders have a plan, free from the constraints of idealistic slogans. Here's what Dick Safransky, a consultant for the U.S. government and corporations, speaking at the 2002 AIAA Defense Conference, said, aired at the time on C-SPAN.
If we prove to be wise, we will even develop a range of asymmetric investment strategies, transformational, to rapidly bring to bear new things employed in novel ways to retain or regain advantage. What this means for us here is that we must improve our ability to think laterally, to dig new holes instead of digging the same old holes deeper? What results give us the most stunning advantages? How do we use asymmetries, technical, psychological, and temporal, to create results? Process improvement and reengineering are not enough.
In other words, he thinks the U.S. must use every means available, maximize unfairness to completely dictate terms of business, bringing about stunning advantages and profits for stockholders. We should get to every opportunity first, with overwhelming technical power, maximize and exploit the sense of inferiority of the local population, and act purely in our own interest, careless to their lives or needs. Without the inconvenience of moral baggage, beyond tinkering with existing colonial and free trade strategies of control and resource extraction, the solution currently in the works is called full-spectrum dominance. In their own words, the U.S. Space Command's Vision for 2020 report states that the United States won't always be able to forward base its forces. Widespread communications will highlight disparities in resources and quality of life, contributing to unrest in developing countries. The global economy will continue to become more interdependent. Economic alliances, as well as the growth and influence of multinational corporations, will blur security agreements. The gap between have and have-not nations will widen, creating regional unrest. One of the long-acknowledged and commonly understood advantages of space-based platforms is no restriction or country clearances to overfly a nation from space. This link to a leaflet from the U.S. Space Command speaks bluntly about using military power for economic gain, and ends with an image of a satellite zapping Baghdad with a laser from space. The world's people have been given a difficult choice. Either live under U.S. domination and exploitation, acquire a nuclear deterrence against the U.S., or covertly engineer a collapse of the U.S. economy. On September 11th, the U.S. economy was clearly targeted more than the military, provoking reactionary policies and spending that have brought into question America's economic viability. More similar attacks will not be difficult to organize and finance by organizations like Al-Qaeda or disgruntled foreign governments. The only hope for Americans is to expose and reverse this doctrine of empire pursued by the Republican and Democratic parties, and return to the basic moral principles our founding fathers espoused more often than they followed. Equality, non-intervention, civil rights, and containment of corporate power. Once again, you can find that article with full links and citations at nhindymedia.org, including a PDF of that U.S. Space Command leaflet and a picture of the laser zapping Baghdad from space. We now bring you a special Veterans Day edition of Take the Power Back from KYRS LPFM in Spokane, Washington, where U.S. Air Force veteran Mike Kress dedicates his show to veterans, their families, and the victims of war.
Now on KYRS LP Spokane, you're listening to a special Veterans Day edition of Take the Power Back, hosted by Mike Kress. Parents, teachers, and students are encouraged to record this program. This special broadcast of Take the Power Back was written, recorded, and produced by Mike Kress, with the additional voices of Terrell McDonald and Rusty Nelson, and music by Pink Floyd, Roger Waters, and Mike Kress. Email us at takethepowerback@kyrs.org or call 509-747-3807.
Working. tight, balanced on the biggest wave, race towards an early grave.
When I stepped off the World Airways MD-11 in Saudi Arabia, the air smelled like sewage, the night's heat felt like a steamy blanket on my face, and the ground war of Desert Storm was over. I was an Air Force crew chief, doing my first Persian Gulf tour during the post-war phase known as Operation Southern Watch. During my 7 years of active duty, I didn't experience combat. There were occasional skirmishes between coalition aircraft and Iraqi forces, but I can't dishonor those who've been in combat by saying I've lived through war. I served indirectly in the pursuit of war. But I've seen enough war at a distance, from the Philippines to the Middle East. During this show, I hope to honor veterans, their families, and the victims of war with some truth. In the words of Orwell, during times of universal deceit, telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act. As we approach Veterans Day, nearly 2,100 troops have died in Iraq, over 15,000 have been wounded, and American casualties escalate annually in Afghanistan. About 100,000 Iraqi people are dead because of our invasion and occupation of Iraq. As the wheels come off the lies that got us there, it's my dream that someday there will be no more veterans. If there are no more veterans, there will be no more victims of war. I went into the military just after I turned 17, during those glorious Reagan years. I lived in Recession, Texas, had no job, little hope of finding a decent job, and I couldn't afford college. The military was my escape. My story is similar to millions of others who've enlisted in the military, most of them signing up to escape poverty, to earn money for college, to find a place where they can achieve goals and acquire skills that'll give them a chance at good jobs when they're civilians again. Sometimes people enlist for adventure, for the travel, because they're patriotic, because they like tanks, fighter planes, or guns, or because they want to kill foreigners, or for a combination of some or all of these reasons, but mostly people join because the military looks like the most affordable path to a more prosperous future. This is often referred to as the economic draft. Now, to get in the military, a young man or woman must go through a recruiter. A recruiter gig is pretty nice. You get to look good because you're paid extra for uniforms. You're usually sharp as hell and represent your service well. And the teenagers you meet, they don't know you, but they think you're pretty cool. Most recruiters are okay in that they're just doing a job they believe in. They won't lie to you, but they won't tell you the whole truth. When times are good for recruiters, when potential recruits are coming in through the window, most recruiters are easygoing and relaxed. They even turn some people away. But when times are tough, when quotas aren't getting met, recruiters get pressured, and that makes them aggressive. Many of them lie or skirt the rules to enlist new recruits. In fact, after parental complaints hit media outlets and school boards, the Pentagon got worried. Things got so bad that in May, the military took an unprecedented day off from recruiting in order to retrain all of its recruiters. Dave Wagner of WLWT News in Cincinnati did a report about recruiting last May 18th and even caught some dishonest recruiters with a hidden camera.
As part of the No Child Left Behind Act, all schools that receive federal funding, and nearly all of them do, are required to give military recruiters access to your child's name, address, and phone number.
From a recruiting standpoint, that's a great thing. Because a lot of the people we couldn't get numbers to actually tell this story, the Army story, or the Armed Forces story to before, we now can.
I'm not trying to do a sales pitch.
But as Target 5 discovered, those military pitches can turn from fact to fiction in a matter of seconds. Target 5 sent four young men with hidden cameras into every tri-state Armed Forces recruiting center. The conversations began with talk of job security.
We guarantee you a job.
Signing bonuses.
Up to $20,000. That's a $20,000.
And cash for college.
$70,000 for college.
But when the questions turn to safety, some tri-state recruiters make Iraq sound more like a trip to Tahiti than a journey to war.
You have more chance of dying here in the United States at a, what is it, 36% kill rate here in the United States. People just dying left and right. You have more chance of dying over here than you do over there.
The U.S. does not have a 36% kill rate. If that were true, more than 100 million people, one-third of the U.S. population, would be killed each year.
To just openly not tell the truth, to push it aside, that's just wrong.
Back at the recruiting center...
The way I am, I'm a noble type of guy.
But you'd never know that, based upon what he tells our young recruit.
If you get on the internet and look up how many deaths are in Columbia, South Carolina in the past year, year and a half, and then compare that to how many deaths in Iraq, there's more deaths going on in Columbia, South Carolina for no reason, none, over a pair of Nikes, over a jacket, people stealing people's wallets, shooting people. There's more deaths going in Columbia, South Carolina. I know I just got back from there. Than there was in the whole time when I was in Iraq.
So Target 5 called the Columbia, South Carolina Police Department. And despite the words of our tri-state recruiter, this city is hardly a hotbed for crime.
There were 16 homicides in the city of Columbia in the year 2004. This year to date, we have 5 in the city.
And if that recruiter thinks Columbia, South Carolina is bad, listen to what this G.I. Joe Isuzu says about the dangers of driving around Dayton, Ohio.
Dayton area alone, which is about 4 or 5 counties, Dayton area alone, 1,500 people died in 2 weeks. You know what that was from? Car wrecks. Those numbers that we get from the actual highway patrol.
Okay.
So, I mean, all that stuff's factual. So you look at it that way, we've lost 1,500 soldiers so far over in Iraq. We've been over there for 3 years.
Right.
If you add it together, 1,500 people die at 5 counties alone within 2 weeks from car wrecks.
The truth is, there aren't 1,500 deaths from car wrecks in the entire state of Ohio for an entire year.
I don't even know where he came up with it. I don't know. It's just insane. Yeah. He could be your car salesman of his.
The national spokesman for the Army Recruiting Command at Fort Knox tells Target 5, I don't know why anybody would even let that phrase even come out of their mouth. For whatever reasons, these recruiters must have found these talking points somewhere on their own. I don't know.
Do you think that in the private conversations they're having with recruits here that they're thinking, no one will ever check this, no one will ever know?
I'm sure that anyone who would tell that, I'm sure that's exactly what they're thinking.
Since the war began, about 1,500 U.S. servicemen and women have been killed in Iraq. The violence has made military recruiting more difficult, often because parents worry about their kids' safety. But recruiters are tracking down teens when parents aren't around, and the pressure can be immense.
How many of you have been approached by a military recruiter in the past year?
In Mr. Jewell's American government class...
Well, I think they're really biased.
Milford High School students are talking about military recruiters.
Recruiter called me up, told me they got a new deal going on, $5,000 to enlist now.
I was told that if I signed up for the Marines, they'd give me a $10,000 signing bonus on the spot. I didn't believe that one.
Signing bonuses and college cash are being used to attract fresh faces to the armed forces. But Army recruiters have missed their quotas for the past 3 months. The Marines short of their goal for the past 4 months. When this high school senior says his parents are concerned about his safety in the military, this recruiter puts on the full court press.
But don't hesitate. Don't leave me hanging. All right. Even if they really don't want to talk about it, we can still sit down and talk. All right, because by you walking in here, that shows that you're interested.
Right.
And I hate for you to be denied this, you know, safe opportunity. Honestly.
Recruiters are supposed to be the top of their career field throughout the United States. Yeah. The best infantry, the best cooks, the best medical technicians, the best, the people that you want to represent your service. Those are the ones you bring out on recruiting duty. There are some soldiers who are great soldiers, but pitiful salesmen.
And of course the news media is going to blow it way out of proportion.
While While some recruiters blame the media for hyping the danger in Iraq, this recruiter who served on the front lines has a straightforward approach.
I'm curious about how dangerous it really is over there, because you know, in the news and everything, people are dying.
It's war.
Yeah.
This week in the tri-state, the realities of war are tragically clear. Another goodbye for two young men who fought and died. Nearly a third of those killed in Iraq are under the age of 22, the vast majority from the Army and Marine Corps, 111 of them from Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky. As a country honors their sacrifice.
Good morning, how's everybody doing?
These high school seniors get ready for their military service.
I'm Craig Kreinest. I go to Harrison High School, and I'm going to the Air Force Academy.
With a send-off and straight talk from their local congressman.
Good luck to you. We need to make sure that those kids who are considering a military career get the true facts. They're great young men and women. They're serving their country or will be in the near future, and we ought to be honest with them. There's no question that Iraq can be a dangerous place.
That was a May 2004 report from WLWT-TV News in Cincinnati. And you're listening to Take the Power Back. Most Americans would say that it's an honorable thing to serve in our military. But military service is only as honorable as the manner in which the military is used. If our military is used dishonorably, as is widely acknowledged to have happened in Vietnam, then everyone's service is tainted by that dishonor. Has our military been used honorably lately? Do we Americans even consider this to be important? And do we as citizens have a role in ensuring our military is used honorably? Some would say no. It's up to the politicians who supposedly have all the facts to make decisions about military force. Others would say that military force is murder, and that when innocent people die, there is no honor in military service. My answer may differ from yours, but ask yourself, should the American military be used honorably, and are we as citizens responsible for how our military is used? If your answer is no, go get a cup of coffee. If your answer is yes, then let's think about how our military has been used recently. Alternative media, Army reports, Red Cross officials, and investigators from non-governmental organizations have documented acts of torture committed by U.S. personnel dating back to the start of the so-called War on Terror. Mainstream media reports reveal that our government has set up a secret gulag, or prison system, where people are locked away without charge, trial, or access to legal counsel. Is there any doubt that torturing prisoners, from Guantanamo Bay to Iraq to Afghanistan, is systemic? Torturing detainees didn't begin in Abu Ghraib, a fact brought home to me when Army Private Lindy England was interviewed last year about her involvement in the torture of Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison. Lindy, photographed with a cigarette clamped in her mouth as Iraqi men were forced to fondle themselves in front of her, Lindy is a small-town girl. And I felt sick while this pathetic young woman told America she was only following orders and felt no guilt about what happened in Abu Ghraib. And I wondered, how could someone described as a decent person find it acceptable to abuse, humiliate, rape, and torture other human beings? How could she find the orders of her superiors lawful? How could she witness the sadistic behavior of her comrades and not object to it? Unfortunately, like Lindy, too many Americans think nothing wrong occurred in Abu Ghraib. As long as America does it, it's okay, right? So the rationalizations rush like water from a spigot. These were pranks, blowing off steam, getting information, confronting terrorism, returning the favor, an eye for an eye, protecting freedom, bringing democracy, giving them what they deserve, treating them in a way they understand. Never mind that 70-90% of the detainees in Iraq were innocent of any wrongdoing. Never mind that those dismissing the abuses would certainly call it torture if it were them or a family member who was raped, paraded naked, sodomized with a broom handle, or attacked by military dogs as cameras caught the crimes. Never mind that such treatment undermines every treaty America ever signed and every value America ever claimed to stand for. Now, I'm overwhelmed not just by the Lindy England's lack of remorse about U.S. war crimes, but also by the lack of concern among the masses of our society. The dishonorable actions of those soldiers make me feel ashamed to be a veteran, and I'm ashamed to be an American when I hear anyone defend such indefensible acts. A nation that engages in torture or sends people to other countries that will torture them, as we've done since 9/11, is not a nation worth respect. A government that commits such crimes is on par with bloody regimes we've condemned. A society that rationalizes the use of torture with excuses like, "we're not as bad as them," is surely at the brink of spiritual collapse. To what are we as a nation setting our moral compass? Where's the bar? I was taught as a kid that we should live up to America's highest ideals, not lower ourselves to the level of animals. Even Republican Senator John McCain, who supports the war in Iraq, has taken a stand against torture and abuse by our military. And he recently said, "This isn't about who the detainees are, this is about who we are. These are the values that distinguish us from our enemies." And let me just add how scary it is that it takes a wealthy, white, conservative politician like McCain to bring Congress around about crimes that some of us have screamed about for years. Now, as responsible as they are for their actions, Lindy England and her fellow low-ranking torturers can't be separated from an entire society that readily reaches for violence to solve almost every problem. And isn't our government part of our society? Doesn't our government, in fact, dominate the public discourse about how we respond to perceived threats? Would there even be a debate about torture if our president and his cronies hadn't used executive orders and creative memos to justify torture? The military is a tool of our foreign policy. If our foreign policy is to torture or assassinate people without trial, the military will naturally be the instrument of that foreign policy. Is that how our country should act? Is that what our troops should be doing? Should our government tell our troops to commit crimes against humanity? Should we expect our troops to follow orders that break the Geneva Conventions? And are we winning the so-called war on terror or anything when our military tortures and murders people? The torture America has inflicted and seems to condone tells me that America is losing its soul. If we are to save it, we must re-examine and embrace the values that make any society great and worthy of respect. And if you think the flag represents liberty and justice for all, you damn well better make sure America's actions are in line with those values. And that includes the way our military is used, and it includes the conduct of every man and woman in the military.
He sat on a pile of stone. He stared at the broken bone in his hand. Strains of a Viennese quartet rang out across the land. Thought to himself, memory is a stranger. History is for fools. And he cleaned his hands in a pool of holy writing. Turned his back on the garden and set out for the nearest town.
Hold on, soldier. Is it any wonder that the monkey's confused? He said, Mama, Mama, the president's a fool. Why do I have to keep reading these technical manuals? And the joint chiefs are staff and the brokers on Wall Street said, don't make a snap, you're a smart kid. Time is linear, memories are strange, history's for fools. Man is a tool in the hands of the great God Almighty. And they gave him command. Nuclear submarine, send him back, search of the Garden of Eden.
That was Roger Waters with a song called Perfect Sense, Part 1. Many people call our service members heroes. But are our troops heroes by virtue of wearing a uniform? Is the meaning of hero diminished when everyone is a hero? Do we call our military men and women heroes to hide from our responsibility for them, to deny our sadness or our shame when we see reports about the dead and the wounded? Do we call them heroes to rationalize why we don't stand up for them when they're sent to kill and die in unnecessary wars without adequate tools and supplies and training and information? Or do we call them heroes to blind ourselves to the suffering they inflict on civilians as they unleash their bullets, bombs, shells, and missiles? Since 9/11, the American public has become more enamored with military power. And why not? The military has been offered as the tonic for every ill in the world by the Bush administration, and to an equal or lesser degree by every administration in our modern history. Here's the thing. Military power is seductive. Those who wield it can become drunk on it, like Bush. Using it can raise your poll numbers if your popularity is low, like Clinton, and the troops make good-looking backdrops when you make a speech. Wars increase the opportunities for medals, and when the military is popular, troops are treated well by civilians who otherwise have little use for the troops. Free beers at the airport, discounts at the mall. However, as America becomes more militaristic, we abandon battles here on the home front. Now, some say the war on terror comes first. They say this war on a word, this war on an idea, must be pursued without mercy, and all enemies must be destroyed, regardless of the cost. And so the war on poverty has been abandoned and considered lost. Few seem to think it can be won, and now America shrugs its collective shoulders at the poor. This, despite the fact that while the war on terrorism spawns new supplies of terrorists, a dedicated war on poverty can actually reduce the number of people who are poor. The war on poverty could be won if the will were there. As our government cuts $9.5 billion from Medicaid, $5 billion from child support enforcement, and $844 million from food stamps, I see only the will to grind the poor past poverty and into pulp. $466 billion taxpayer dollars went toward the military last year. And that doesn't include what we paid for Iraq and Afghanistan or the secret intelligence budget. And the rest of the entire world spent about $500 billion for military. Now, our closest competitor in military spending was China, which spent about $65 billion last year. Meanwhile, the U.S. forked out a measly $55 billion on education in 2004. Only 34% of our tax dollars will go to human resources next year, while 48% will go to military programs. So while there's ever more machinery for wars, there's less bread and butter for the poor, not to mention assistance for heating, medical care, child care, education, and housing. Yet even as poverty increases and hunger expands and the middle class shrinks, some among us are getting rich or richer from war. Now, we've heard about Halliburton, Dick Cheney's former company, and Kellogg Brown and Root, corporations that have reaped multi-billion, no-bid contracts from our government. Unfortunately, war profiteering is nothing new. Big business, the military, and the government have long been tied together in an incestuous relationship. It's just more accepted now. Abraham Lincoln witnessed war profiteering and corporate involvement in war. In a letter to William F. Elkins during the Civil War, President Lincoln wrote,
As a result of the war, corporations have been enthroned, and an era of corruption in high places will follow. And the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people, until all wealth is aggregated in a few hands, and the republic is destroyed. I feel at this moment more anxiety for the safety of my country than ever before, even in the midst of war. God grant that my suspicions may prove groundless.
Well, Abe, your suspicions weren't groundless. Former Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, no bleeding heart liberal, spoke about the danger of the military-industrial complex during his presidential farewell speech.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals.
Now, some people might dismiss Eisenhower and Lincoln as self-interested politicians. So what would a fighting man's fighting man say about the influence of capitalism on our country, our citizens, and our men and women in uniform? Well, here are the words of America's most decorated general, Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler, from his 1930s book, War is a Racket.
War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. Out of war, a few people make huge fortunes. Out of war, nations acquire additional territory if they're victorious. They just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few, the selfsame few who wrung dollars out of blood in the war. The general public shoulders the bill. But the soldier pays the biggest part of the bill. If you don't believe this, visit the American cemeteries on the battlefields abroad, or visit any of the veterans' hospitals in the United States.
Can't you see? It all makes perfect sense. Expressed in dollars and cents, pounds, shillings, and pence. Can't you see? It all makes perfect sense.
Submarine camp.
That was Roger Waters with a song called Perfect Sense Part 2.